Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and get a $25 service credit when you sign up.
He's Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense.
I would like to explain the origins of today's show. I came into the studio this morning. It's Saturday. And intending, by the way, to work on the Hardcore History Program, which is what I do right now, endlessly and without ever releasing anything, apparently. And the playback mechanism that allows me to hear the latest edited version, you know, where we are, that I have to thread into where we're going and all this kind of stuff was broken. So a quick call to Ben, if there is a Ben, and he's working on that now. And if there is a Ben, he had an interesting suggestion for me, saying that since my lips were not at the moment flapping on any sort of work-related project, maybe I could flap them on a current events or political issue. And as he said, maybe, even if you only got 15 minutes, that's 15 minutes more than you had. We could release that. And so this may be 15 minutes for all. And it could be 5 minutes. We could start doing five-minute podcasts once every 4 months. I think that's about saturation point, don't you? nonetheless, there are some interesting things worth at least bringing up. There was a Democratic primary debate, the first one, by the way, the other night that I managed to live tweet my way through. So I got one thing accomplished. And we can talk about some of the ramifications of that. And more importantly, I think we could get into for a little bit the latest development in the ongoing situation in Syria, which just adds a fascinating twist to an already remarkably interesting international situation, which because of its interest level combined with the humanitarian nightmare that it is, almost makes you feel guilty for finding it interesting. I mean, we've talked before on the History Show about that strange sort of guilt you feel being entertained by experiences that other people went through that often are the worst thing that ever happened to them. There's many ways to console yourself and rationalize that to yourself. You'll say something like, well, it was a long time ago. Or you'll say, you know, it's the past, it's done, there's nothing you can do about it. But when you look at a situation like Syria, those things don't apply anymore. Not only is it not the past, it's in real time going on right now. And I'm not sure that you can argue that there's nothing we can do about it. Now, I think you can argue that you could do something about it, but the results might be random. It might help, but maybe it's like sticking your finger in a light socket and saying, might help, might not, don't know, try it. I mean, I think that's where it is right now. It's become fascinating with the entry of Russia into the situation in the last couple of weeks. I mean, absolutely fascinating. We'll talk about that aspect of it. I think that's what most Americans are all of a sudden going, what the heck does that mean? Which is part of what makes it interesting. All of these things are incidental, though, to the humanitarian disaster that's going on there. And brings me to a more logical starting point, I guess, if we're going to focus on this in terms of what really matters first, which are the people that are being displaced, killed, I mean, barrel bombs dropping on them, being the victims of these various groups that are running around in some of these destabilized areas. ISIS, for example, ISIL, which is, you know, you could probably split the responsibility for ISIL between an Iraq scenario and a Syria scenario about 50-50. There's so much destabilization and suffering, obviously. You see it bleeding over into Europe right now as part of the immigration problem that we talked about in the last show. It's a little like Syria's an open wound, and they're really hurting, but the pain is radiating elsewhere. You're going to feel a little of Syria's pain. It's part of what makes it difficult to just sort of say, well, you know, that's a long way away. It's a quagmire. What are you going to do? Glad it's not happening here, because you're going to feel the pain, right, one way or the other. It also gets to the root of our post-First World War and post-Second World War, you know, change in, what would you call them, change in global attitudes about what we're willing to say we can live with. Because as you watch this stuff, I mean, there is a palpable feeling, and I don't know if it's all over the world, but I feel like it's in a lot of the world, where when you watch these things, you just think, well, we just can't stand for this. You read about these massacres and you hear about these things going on and you just, it just looks like a nightmare. And you think, well, we can't stand for this. Somebody's got to make a move and do something about this. You do not hear a lot of people going, what are you going to do? Now, Sometimes you do if you don't hear much about it. There can be things going on in some little out of the way part of the world that are absolutely horrifying, but people don't hear about them. So you never get that sort of sense of something's got to be done about this. But when you look at a situation like Syria, it seems callous to just say, oh, I think you just have to leave that. And not good for security either, because look at how the unintended things that get spawned from this violence can turn around and then create all sorts of subsidiary problems for you. Easy to overlook a Syria and say, hey, we don't like the Assad people anyway. I'm glad something's going to happen. Good luck to the rebels. And then you end up with an ISIS in control of oil wells and part of a destabilized Syria. And all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, maybe we did have a stake in this, right? It's always interesting to contemplate the dichotomy between a fact that you know that exists, right? And that fact is that I know that we have, for example, military planners in our government that spend exquisite amounts of time working out every contingent that could possibly happen. I mean, it's famous. I mean, the military has got a plan just in case Canada invades. I mean, you know, it's proverbial. And while it's popular amongst our population to blame, especially an administration from the opposite party, George W. Bush blamed by liberals, Barack Obama blamed by conservatives for their ineptitude in policy decisions, let's remember that this is a foreign policy structure with a lot of people below the presidential and congressional levels, you know, that are lifers, basically, and that have been doing this for a long time. This is why it becomes inexplicable sometimes when things happen that fully should have been noticed, and we look like we've been caught so off guard. The number one most interesting thing that happened in the last couple of weeks in the Syrian situation is the Russian involvement. And we look like we've been caught as flat-footed as we did when Putin did it in eastern Ukraine. Now, by the way, we did some shows back then on that situation. And you know, it's interesting to notice the differences in the situation and the similarities. One of the main differences is in that program, we highlighted over and over again the question of proximity as it relates to threat level. So in other words, if the United States is threatened by a country in Central Africa, we have one level of worry about that. If instead we're threatened by Mexico, it's a different level of concern, right? As anybody could understand. So we were talking about, you know, the fact that since the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russians have been dealing with things on their periphery. I remember when the situation in Georgia and Chechnya was going on, that the idea at the time by the foreign policy contingent of experts was that Russia was reasserting its authority, you know, in some of its border regions. Now, with Ukraine, it's a similar situation. You have something right over the border, right? So people, including yours truly, pointed out Russia's regional superpower status. But if you're Vladimir Putin, this move in Syria is a serious maneuver on the chessboard to say we're not a regional power. We're the second most strong power in the world right now. And that deserves a little respect. I mean, to me, it looks totally like a respect move, because you could have done this at any time. And you could have done it any number of different ways. I mean, in Ukraine, the Russians came in there sort of by pretending that they didn't. And then when it was an open secret, it was sort of a wink and a nod thing. But there was never any, you know, march of Russian soldiers and lots of press coverage by Russian outlets and all this. The move into Syria was an open one. It was basically showing a Russia that will openly support an ally, which we would do too, let's be honest, and coming in to fly air missions as countries like the United States have somehow assumed is sort of the thing we do. I mean, the funny thing is everybody knows that this could happen, but we're still surprised that it did. Everybody knows that Russians can fly air missions. We've seen them do it in other places, but all of a sudden to see them projecting power in a faraway place seems to catch us off guard. Now, if this was the old Soviet Union and this is the middle 1960s, we wouldn't think twice about it. We would know that they would do this, right? We would expect it. We would ask in any global chessboard situation that we were involved in, now, what will the Russians do? How will they react? What will they think about this? I think Vladimir Putin is trying to restore that. I think he wants the rest of the world to consider what Russia thinks about given situations, the way it used to. Now, this is interesting because there are a couple of different lines of thinking on the Vladimir Putin trying to recreate the Soviet Union idea. One is somewhat popular amongst those who live next to Russia, and you can understand why, who will say, listen, what Vladimir Putin wants is a physical restoration of the old Soviet Union. He wants all these countries that broke away and he wants them reincorporated physically or in some sort of Warsaw Pact recreation, you know, tied right back to Russia. This is an overt move to physically recreate the Soviet Union. But then there are others, and I think I fall into this camp, that feel like he's itching more for the prestige and world position of the old Soviet Union, but just having that attached to Russia. In other words, basically, if you look at Russia, you may say, okay, it's not the old Soviet Union, but we're still the biggest landmass country in the world. We're probably the number two country in the world when it comes to physical power and military, you know, power. Why shouldn't we be a consideration? We may not be the United States, but we're not chopped liver. I suppose that's a logical thing to expect. And I think part of the move into Syria right now is Russia's way to once again say, well, you know, we have a say in how this goes, too. And by the way, this is an ally of ours. And you're a little naive to think we might not at some point decide to defend an ally. And I think there's a lot of things where we should have gone, what are we going to do when the Russians come in to defend their ally? We would have thought about that 30 years ago. I think there's still a bit of surprise. As I said before, you know, this generation of experts I just praised also were not the people running the show the last time they had to be concerned about what another great power might do. These are people who exist in the, you know, time when America has hegemony, and worrying about what other countries do is not something that's really worth spending a ton of time on. I know they still do it, but then why did we appear so caught off guard when Putin did what he did? Now, what's different than Ukraine? The Russians are projecting power. Power projection is considered amongst military, you know, powers to be a big dividing line. Most states can't do it. The United States is one of the few that can. Arguably, there were people that I would have been able to argue with a couple of weeks ago that would have said the United States is really the only state that can in any meaningful way. You heard Hillary Clinton in the debate that just happened suggest that because the United States is one of the few powers, if maybe the only power, who can do this, it exerts certain responsibilities on us. You know, you can't really get mad at the Swedes if they don't do it, if they don't have the capability to do it. But if we have the capability to do it and we don't, well, you know, there's a moral responsibility that comes into play when you can accomplish something. But if you're the only person with a gun in the neighborhood and the bad guy comes in or the bear comes in and you don't use the gun, what did that say? Now, let's be honest. This amount of power projection is not insane. I mean, it doesn't take United States type capabilities to get an air campaign going. They have to put people on the ground to support the air campaign. My favorite part of this whole thing, which again shows to me how much of a publicity move, a prestige move it is, was the shooting of cruise missiles from ships offshore. Didn't exactly have any real effect, but it was kind of like saying, you've seen the United States do this. Well, you know, we're a great power too. We can shoot cruise missiles off ships too. I mean, I really think this is all part of a move to become more relevant. If you recall, the United States is major foreign policy planks since the fall of the Soviet Union. One of them has always been to deter anyone who would even seek to be a military competitor. I think this is Putin's way of saying, you know, whatever the second strongest power is on the planet, that's us. And you can choose to ignore us if you want. But we just screwed up your whole Syrian Middle Eastern policy with one move. And he did. This is the other thing that you just look at and you shake your head and you go, really? We are so muddled right now in terms of our approach to Syria that Vladimir Putin just walked in and decided the situation. And I know you may think, oh, Dan, he really didn't do that yet. This is very fluid and up in the air. I don't think so. Not if he wants to stay. And the reason why is because we don't care as much as they do. We're not going to maintain our effort to the level that, you know, this is the same thing you got into the Vietnam situation, right? If the United States wants to conquer Vietnam in the 1960s, a la Germany 1945, you can, but we didn't have the, you know, same level of interest that the people on the other side did. It was their country, right? They're going to outlast you because they have a much more serious, you know, thing at stake. For us, this whole Syrian thing is already tiresome. The latest thing is that a $500 million plan to train our own, you know, friendly, good, democratic, non-human rights abusing force to overthrow the government failed miserably, and we had to admit it. You don't see that very often. And now when you read some of these good articles out there talking about the situation, the problem that the U.S. has going right now is we really don't have anyone we can support. We've gotten used to fighting these wars through other people where we decide, okay, these are the best people we could ally with in this area, and we start funneling arms to them, and then we find out later that, you know, sometimes these people even get in power, and you go, well, shoot, maybe we shouldn't help them. But at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. The situation in Syria has gotten to the point where the polarization is to such a degree that any of the groups you might want to support don't exactly look like good guys. And the group we have been kind of casting our lot in with for a long time, the Kurds, there are starting to be problems between different Kurds in different regions like Syria and Iraq versus how that goes into Turkey. And there was a terrible, worst terrorist attack, I believe, ever in Turkey a couple of weeks ago relating to the same Kurdish issue. And it's starting to, you know, the idea of just willy-nilly saying, well, these are the best people in the region, we'll support them, is starting to bleed over into other situations. And the Turkish one, by the way, was always something that everyone knew was kind of a line you had to be careful around. But now with the U.S. and our friends, not exactly sure who becomes your champion in this conflict, you open up the door to people who have no doubt about who their champion is. The Russians support the Assad regime. That's who they want to win. Now, we've talked before, and I'm not going to go into it too deeply, but just to understand, the Assad regime happened to be Alawites, which is an interesting version of Islam, usually but not always tied directly to the Shia version of Islam, which is why they're natural allies with the Iranians. It's why Hezbollah can act in the Assad regime's interest at this point, too. And so you basically have a formidable coalition that's now developed with the addition of Russia openly involved in airstrikes and whatnot between Iran, Hezbollah, the Russians, and the Syrians that could defeat any force we could back. And again, it looks like they were playing chess while we were just kind of fooling around. David Ignatius over at the Washington Post wrote, quote, "Moscow is bidding for overall leadership of the anti-extremist fight," end quote, there. In other words, taking the lead against ISIS and all these kinds of things. Robert Fisk a couple of weeks ago was thinking that Putin might even have on his mind rescuing the ruins at Palmyra before ISIS destroyed them. He didn't get there in time if that was what he wanted, but basically insinuating what a publicity coup it would be if it was the Russian military that came in and saved this World Heritage site from destruction, right? Again, that shows you, I think, the connection between this move and the raising of a public profile, the public relations side of this, the message that's trying to be sent above and beyond the idea that Russian interests probably would not be well served if the Assad regime were toppled. I think they care about that, but I think the way that they're publicizing and going about this entire effort shows that they want to be noticed, right? They came here to be noticed. They wore the loud clothes and made sure you heard them coming a long way away. It's going to be very interesting to see what our, and I'm talking about the U.S. here, what our long-term reaction to this kind of stuff is. I mean, if the foreign policy lean for the last 20 years has been don't have any competitors, what do you do if a competitor appears and emerges anyway? I would suggest that one thing you are seeing, which I've always found fascinating, and I think it's got to be one of the downsides. I've read Victor Davis Hanson books where he tries to talk up and extol the many advantages that a democratic society has over a dictatorship in terms of warfare. You know, how democratic armies, you know, are so absolutely murderous and effective, especially against these dictatorial regimes. And I think he's got a point in those histories. But the other side of the equation is also very interesting. And I think people like Hitler had talked about this sort of thing. The fact that democracies are a lot more sort of haphazard in their courses of action, though, Whereas oftentimes these dictatorial regimes act with, I think Hitler said, one brain, right? So you have like the brain of the nation unified with a policy, and a policy that might be so complicated that it plans several moves ahead. In a democratic system, it's very difficult to plan several moves ahead. So much can change. Leadership can change. Ideas can change. Public mood can change. In some of these other countries, a guy like Putin can sit there and go, okay, now the next move is here, and in 2 years I'm going to do this, and in 2 years I'm going to do that. And assuming that he's still around, he can actually execute a long-term plan of action. And I think there's one of his advantages. He may not have Victor Davis Hanson's murderous democratic army once roused, but he does have the ability to decide a long-term strategy. And I think you could make a case that the Ukraine situation was part of one raising of a prestige level. We're not going to allow unfriendly states this close to us. No great state would, putting words in their mouth. And now this is a little like saying there are other countries that can come in and fight terrorism. We can lead the fight against terrorism. We can be a force for good in the world. It's weird. Sorry, can I just take a little, how weird did that just sound? It sounded weird to me too. You know, we think of Vladimir Putin as a bad guy here in the United States, and I don't like dictatorial regimes and heavy-handed regimes at all, so he's not my kind of guy. But wouldn't it be interesting if the way he wants to clothe himself, and Russians might say, Dan, you're being very unfair to him, he's better than you think, and look at what he's doing, and if he can save lives in Syria, you know, will you not give him credit for that? That's interesting, isn't it? If the Russians came in and improved the humanitarian situation on the ground, that's interesting to consider, isn't it? I'll tell you what I like about the situation, and this is maybe a little realpolitik for my moral code, but I just feel like it's nice to have somebody else doing things in that region that could make the locals angry at them, spread out the anger a little bit more. You know, if the Russians are attacking groups that they call terrorists, which, by the way, is what we do too, But who is a terrorist is a wonderful interpretive question. And the reason the term has always been so popular is that, you know, a terrorist is whatever you say a terrorist is. And unfortunately for us, as many of you probably know, some of the terrorists that the Russians are striking are people that we kind of support, hoping that they will help topple the government. So there's a belief here that you almost have another almost Cold War-style proxy war going on, where it's going on through the various groups we support or the governments we support. And now the Russians are striking Chechen groups that are in that area. They're going after perhaps U.S.-backed groups. They are attacking some ISIS sites too, you should say. But how would we feel if the Russians dealt with ISIS? And let's understand something. Part of the reason they would stand perhaps a better chance than we would is that the people that they're working with are people that we're just starting to talk to nicely, people like the Iranians, who have an interest in all of it too. They're anti-ISIS, and they're also friendly with the Assad regime in Syria. And so all of these elements are in play to be used against someone like ISIS. How would the United States feel if things that we would look at as great policy achievements, if we did them, how would we look at those same achievements if we didn't do them, but someone else did? Now, here's the thing. I don't put any humanitarian sentiments in Vladimir Putin's, you know, attitude. I think this is all realpolitik. I think this is, as I said, a flexing of muscles on the world stage and part of a step-by-step attempt to clearly claim a superpower status again, right? I mean, the United States may say, listen, there are no Soviet Union. This is not nowhere near as bad, but they can still say, listen, we're the next greatest competitor you have, and you better consider what we might do in any situation, because if you don't, we might spring something on you, and you might be surprised like you were in Ukraine. You might be surprised like you were in Syria. If you don't factor in the idea of what we might do, you're going to get blindsided, because we'll do what you don't think we can do. We'll project power. Now we have to take into account that it's potentially a reality that the Russians could intervene anywhere in the world they wanted to. I guarantee you we were not thinking that was the case a couple years ago. This is why you have, by the way, some of the neoconservative right, you know, so admiring of the Putin chess game. I mean, they like this kind of stuff. To them, this is playing the great game at the highest level, right? Now, to me, to a person of my particular foreign policy beliefs, I think my attitude, which is, you know, Martian and crazy, so take it with a grain of salt. But see, I'd let the Russians do all this stuff. I would be happy that they're doing it. I would use it as an excuse to move out of these areas. Now, understand something. I'm not the one receiving campaign donations from people who want to have lucrative mineral rights in this particular valley of Syria. I mean, come on, I'm not in on all that. So I'm not playing that game. That may be a concern of people who are making these policy decisions, and they're probably thinking that naive guy doing the podcast doesn't even understand what this is all about. Nonetheless, on a totally surface level, I'm thinking, what the heck? If the Russians want this responsibility, let them have it, because it comes with blowback and a lot of money spent, and everybody's going to be mad at you after a while. And they're going to start looking at you every time you have a tragedy somewhere, and it would be nice to have somebody else with the capability, so that when there was something terrible going on somewhere, but that contained a lot of possible risk and blowback and all kinds of other things, we could say, hey, don't look at us. The Russians can do that too. Might be good having another superpower around. The job's a little heavy for us all by ourselves. At least that's my opinion. I watched John Kerry yesterday. And to show you, by the way, how I don't even know how to, deranged, is deranged the right thing to say? It's not deranged, just they think we're deranged. John Kerry was talking about Russian involvement in Syria the other day, and you know, he said the typical line, U.S. goals in Syria, just so you know, folks, are, a negotiated settlement that does not include the Assad family, right? They've got to be gone. The Russian victory conditions are a settlement where the Assad family is still in charge. So they are absolutely head-to-head, diametrically opposed. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, said that what we're shooting for in Syria, the goal, and I'm quoting here, is a unified secular Syria. A unified Syria that is, you know, essentially like the United States, right? Multi-religious, not Sharia law, all those kind of things. Are you crazy? Are you delusional and unified? Look at it now. We can't even find a group to support because of the way it's so disunified. I mean, here's the thing to consider here, folks. That's just politics speak. That's just for our consumption. Nobody is that dumb saying our policy goals are unified secular Syria and the return of unicorns to the animal kingdom. I mean, what are you talking about? This is why we're going to get our clock. If that's really what we think, by the way, this is why we will get our clock cleaned by someone who's got as realistic a mission as Vladimir Putin has in that region, right? Prop up the regime. You can do that. A unified secular Syria. You can't do that. Also, it looks to me like the Russians have also thought about the next step. If you prop up the Syrian government, what happens next? Will you get a return to the way things were? What's our game plan for if the Syrian government falls? What do we do then? Right. Who does it fall to? Does it fall to ISIS? Does it fall to, you know, the whole thing just seems like there's absolutely no good choices, but we dive in deeper anyway. Now, look, I said, and I mean it, the people in our government who are the lifers, who think about the foreign policy challenges and who go over all the possible scenarios and plan Bs and contingencies and all that stuff, these are really smart people. They don't change administration to administration for the most part. They do this for a long time. They've done it for a long time. How is this happening? How do we look so lost? Some of the things that we task both our military but also our political and financial capital to do seem like utopian dreams. I mean, famously, right, we're going to bring democracy to the Middle East, which will then, you know, topple from one country to another, you know, like dominoes where nations will fall and the people will vote and everything will be great. And then how did that go, right? The world is much more complicated than that. Were we really thinking that that was what was going to happen? Are we that naive? I can't tell. Anyone who gets involved in this Syria thing and the goal is a unified secular Syria, what the heck is our plan once Assad's gone? Once he goes the way of Muammar Gaddafi and they, you know, kill him in the streets and, you know, the day after that, what do we do? I mean, just this doesn't appear to be thought out. Now, you know, I'm biased, right? My attitude is often that this is not our business. in part because we don't know what we're doing, in part because none of these people are the kind of people we can reliably back without being embarrassed down the road, because they may do horrible things to each other, right? All of these people have human rights records that are far from enviable. Who do you want to back? I guess a question that yours truly would have, coming from Mars as I do, is why is the natural inclination always that we have to back somebody?
We got to find some group we can funnel arms to that can push for a democratically unified secular Syria.
I mean, what the heck? These are hard things to do when they're thought out well. But when it sounds so amorphous, and again, maybe we just aren't told the real goals. That maybe, Dan, the real goals are the lithium deposits in the Baikal Valley. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, okay, in which case we sound like idiots. They like what we're doing. Now we're the useful dummies who can sit there and debate an issue that is not really what is going on. So I take into account the idea that this may be stupid like a fox type stuff. I'll tell you what, though. I would say from a purely, you know, pain to result ratio, if Vladimir Putin somehow, some way stumbled into a situation that ended up easing the humanitarian crisis, lessening the flow of traumatized immigrants to Europe, stabilizing the situation on the ground so that neither outside groups nor the government were killing civilians, it would be hard to say that that wasn't an improvement. And it would be hard not to give the Russians credit and say, I know you probably have ulterior motives. I know this may not work out well for us long term, but I got to give you credit. Less people are dying. And at the moment, that was more than we were able to accomplish. I don't know. It's not life or death to me that Assad leaves. I hate that regime, and I hated his father, Hafez al-Assad, too. But if you're talking about getting rid of them, I think you have to say, for what? And I got news for you. None of those different people I'm looking at particularly looks like they're going to be a humanitarian upgrade. I don't know. I think you'd have to try it to find out. I just don't want to be the one left holding the bag if I make the wrong decision. For once, it'd be nice to, you know, send that responsibility off to somebody else. If you want to say, who's responsible for screwing up Syria, I'd love to be able to say, well, the Russians screwed that up. We had our hands off. They wanted the job, we gave it to them, and they screwed it up. Nice to have somebody else to say that about for a change, don't you think? Finally, I'd like to say a little something about the first of the Democratic debates that happened the other night. And before I even go there, isn't it interesting, if you're a junkie like I am about this kind of stuff, to watch what's going on in the Democratic Party as we see the people that actually want the party to be sort of an open electoral mechanism clashing with the people who want to stage manage this because they want to win? Remember, there are things called superdelegates, and this is especially big in the Democratic Party. The real role of superdelegates, folks, is to make sure that the people of this country don't pick the wrong candidate from the Democratic Party's standpoint. The superdelegates are the party elite, the old line guys and gals, and their job is to make sure, oh my God, you know, no Bernie Sanders at the last minute, if necessary, right? They're the last line of defense in a worst-case scenario. The worst-case scenario right now for the Democratic Party is that anybody but Hillary Clinton gets the nomination. Which is, you know, again, I hate taking pleasure from systemic problems, but watching the Democratic Party handle the Hillary Clinton thing is a little like me always asking, you know, for that emperor has no clothes moment. I want the duopoly exposed. I want folks to see that these parties aren't about the country or about you, the voter for the party. It's an entirely different thing. And you get to see it a little bit more now when you watch, you know, how the party, for example, you know, shades things because they want a particular candidate. They don't care what you want. They have a candidate they think will win. They're strategizing this not based on, listen, the country in 3 years, 4 years. I mean, it's just, folks, this is about winning elections. And we kid ourselves when we pretend it's about more than that. Now, everybody will say, well, of course it's about more than that, but you have to win the election to get to that point. The election's never over. That's why we see the politics continue, you know, all the way through from one election to another. You see the other Democratic candidate, I mean, Jim Webb, who was in the debate the other night, said it was rigged for Hillary Clinton. There are Democratic National Committee members who are getting in trouble for disagreeing with the number of debates, which is considered to be abnormally low to aid the front runner, which is Hillary Clinton.
I mean, there's a bunch of that kind of stuff. It's fun to watch the party mechanism exposed. What did Bismarck famously say? Those who don't like to watch sausage making shouldn't watch government being done, something like that. It's a little like that when you get a chance to see a little bit behind the curtain of internal party politics. The debate itself is surreal, like they always are, because afterwards it's judged on a win or loss basis. And generally, the win or loss is all about how they comported themselves, right? How did they look? Did they answer the question snappily? Did they look phased? Were they unnerved? A lot of times, unless there's some horrible gaffe, you know, I think we should nuke the Russians. I mean, that kind of gaffe makes the news. But otherwise, if it's all relatively within the confines of normalcy, then it's all about presentation and poise and all those kinds of things. Which takes me back to the very first international relations class I had in college was by a German professor. Brompton, Henry Brompton was his name, and he was about 90 years old, I remember, but he was fascinating. He yelled at us in a German accent, but what was so great about him is he had this perspective where he's teaching American international relations from an American viewpoint, but having been raised in another environment. And one of the things he says is that the American governmental system has put two jobs into the hands of a single office, and it messes things up. He said, in Europe, in most countries, we have someone like a prime minister and then another person who's like the president or the chancellor. And they have two different jobs. The prime minister is the bean counter. This is what Henry Brompton, I'm sure long dead in political science in 1983 in college, would say. The bean counter is the person you elect for their ability on policy issues. This is where you get your wonky people. He says the problem is that most people do not want that wonky-looking, nerdy person as the face of the nation, so you have a different job for that, right? You have a president or a chancellor. They're the ones that go to the big state funerals, and when you think about, you know, who would be on the poster representing the nation, it's that person, right? He says, in the United States, you should have two offices instead of just the president. One is where John Wayne gets elected. And he's on the poster. And when you see the United States of America, who's the chancellor or the president? John Wayne is, you know, because that's the image we have for ourselves. Then you could elect any old bald guy you want to be the president. And who cares? They're not going to be on the big poster. He says it screws your system up because your country continually makes decisions based on who it wants to see on the big poster. They're voting for the chancellor when they need to be voting for the prime minister. The 1960 televised debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy is famously the one everybody points to as the moment that, how was it Adlai Stevenson put it, that you started marketing the president of the United States like breakfast cereal? But that's the one where famously Nixon is supposed to have won the radio debate on the issues, but supposedly didn't wear makeup. Kennedy had a tan, wore makeup, looked great, and was perceived by the TV audience to have won. In other words, he had the poise, right? He had the snappy answers. It wasn't about policy. That was a radio sort of thing. And once that debate happened, and you cross that sort of Rubicon when it comes to political marketing, it's interesting to see how things changed. You know, follically challenged like I am, I couldn't help but notice that, you know, you haven't had a bald president since. The last bald president we had was Eisenhower, who, by the way, was in the race during that comment by Adlai Stevenson about the presidency being marketed like breakfast cereal. And Adlai Stevenson should have known he was the other candidate that Eisenhower faced in two elections, who also happened to be one of the few men in America with less hair than Eisenhower. So in other words, the last time we had a bald president, a two-term bald president in the United States of America, he was running against a guy who had even less hair than he. That seems to me to be a non-standard variable, shall we say, in the question. But the point is that this is when the perception of who you want, you know, becomes so visual and so emotional. I mean, my mother loved John F. Kennedy, and it had nothing to do with any politics at all, right? She was not going to vote against John F. Kennedy, even if every issue he espoused went against her core. In a climate like this, imagine what a Kardashian would do if they entered the Democratic race at the last minute. Forget Joe Biden. You know, bring in Kim Kardashian, and let's see her shake up the race. I mean, let's be honest, it's a little like what we see on the Republican side right now, huh? So, poise aside, I thought Hillary Clinton looked fabulously poised, but I never expected anything else. That's what she's selling, ladies and gentlemen. Poise, I'm a woman, and I was with President Obama and the Secretary of State doing the yeoman's work of government. Here's the problem. If all of us are dissatisfied with how the yeoman's work of government is going, that's not a particular plus I'd be espousing on, right? I guess Democrats are happy, I think. Isn't that what the assumption is with President Obama? I don't know how anybody could be happy with anything going on right now. That's just me. When she says I'm a woman, that is the best thing she has going. And I'm sad. You know, I'd love to see 5 women in the race. And then, you know, the I'm a woman thing would not be such a big deal. Then we could say, okay, I like all these women. Which is the one I like the best? And then all of a sudden, if you have like 5 women and any one of them getting elected would be able to break that important barrier, which I think is important, of having a first female president, then you wouldn't have to say, well, listen, if we want a first female president, it either has to be Hillary or Carla Fiorina. Those are your choices. It's a pity. As I've said, President Obama, the greatest legacy he may have brought to the office, he might have brought on the very first day. I don't think we can discount at all that having the first, at least partially African-American president is a very big deal. And I feel the same way about having a woman president. I'm sorry that this is our choice because I don't like Hillary at all. And I didn't like her husband and I didn't like that administration. And they're all way too slick and insider and everything by my standards, right? If you're anti-corruption, if you think this country needs reform at a very deep level, these are not the people you want, right? Now, that brings us to someone like Bernie Sanders. This was a very important debate for Sanders, too, right? And a lot of really passionate people feel the burn, right? The self-admitted democratic socialist. I have to say, listen, I'm quirky, but having a guy who sounds like a New York Jewish guy up there, you know, instead of poised and polished and sounding like you have no accent, and having somebody with that brought some character to it for me. I'm so tired of these plastic people in the same way that... The thought of Donald Trump winning, and I know a lot of you actually have started to warm to Trump. I have not warmed to Trump, but I do like him in this because I love how he exposes the plasticness of everyone else. I feel like right away when Sanders spoke, and he'd spoken after a couple of the other people, I think Webb and maybe Chafee, when he spoke, it was so the opposite of the other guys who sounded so stiff and plastic and rehearsed and prepared and politicians and eraser clappers and all this. There's no question that to a guy like me, who believes that the amount of reform we need goes beyond tweaking, for me, you're not voting for fixing things if you're not voting for people that are saying, listen, we can't just plaster over some of this stuff. There's going to have to be some tearing down and rebuilding. This pillar has to be replaced. And that person might be a person to the left of me who feels that way. That person might be a person to the right of me who feels that way. But if they're not seeing the necessary need for the same level of reform, to me, they're out of my consideration picture, which is why I always pick these people you all hate, or most of you hate. I guess what I'm saying is I prefer the people outside the status quo on either side because I think they're the only ones who see how big the problem is or who have the political freedom to act or at least promise to act in a method that is outside conservative tweaking, right? So in that sense, I was listening to Sanders carefully and his message carefully. You know, here's my only problem with the whole democratic socialist thing, because I see what he's saying in a lot of respects. And listen, I don't think that countries like the Scandinavian countries get enough credit for how nice they are. If you go there, one of the things that's interesting is from, and this is a totally American perspective, that when you see that, it's hard to reconcile all the scare stories we all grow up with about socialism. Right. And once upon a time, we understood the debate pretty well. The debate used to be, listen, you want a society like Sweden, be prepared to have taxes as high as the Swedes pay. Right. OK, well, I suppose that's a legitimate debate right there. The problem is that taxes in the United States now in certain areas, I mean, the way the whole thing is set up now, we're paying closer to what they're paying over there now. It's not such a huge gap anymore where you can sit there and go, you're saving a lot of money. That's not one of the arguments that's easy to use anymore against the socialists. Now you have to talk about economic freedom and stuff like that. Nonetheless, I like that line of Sanders comparing us to Denmark, and I understand all that. But what I've never really been a fan of is this idea that you're going to solve economic problems by taxing the rich, or that the idea here should be that the rich don't pay enough taxes, they need to pay more taxes. I mean, to me, it feels punitive when I'm looking for some leader who's going to solve our problems. Now, the problem in my mind when you talk about, and I'm using air quotes here, the rich, is that they control the darn political system. That's what has to change. You know, then we'll let other things figure itself out. But this idea that the way you increase prosperity for the rest of the country is by taxing
you know, other people in the country more. I mean, you know, listen, this idea that we have to get rid of income inequality, I don't like that idea either. There's no problem with the super rich if, one, they aren't controlling the political system, and I have people who will argue that that's inevitable, so maybe that's a point right there, but they shouldn't be controlling the political system. The other thing is that the people at the bottom end of the scale need to be doing better. That's what needs to be focused on. It's too darn expensive to be part of the middle class anymore. You know, I was talking to my wife about how the middle class shrinks, and the way the middle class shrinks is it just becomes more expensive to stay in the middle class. Sometimes you'll find out what someone's making and you're thinking, God, they're doing pretty well. And you look at their lifestyle and you realize, no, they're not. They're living a middle class lifestyle that costs a fortune. That's how the middle class shrinks. People who make $80,000 a year and look lower middle class. That's a problem. I'm not sure you solve that problem by taxing the rich more. Does that make sense? It's the same thing where it drives me crazy where people say, I'm going to help the poor people. We're going to offer another tax break for this. And you go, that is the cheap-ass way to try to say you're doing something about real systemic important problems going into the 21st century. Like, how do people make a decent living? And how do we create enough opportunity to keep things like the American dream viable? And we're going to give you a little tax break if you sell a home within an extra 6 months. I mean, come on. That's called, I need a political thing that's going to cost me nothing, not upset any of my donors, but sound like I'm going to do something for people who need help. So that's my problem with the Bernie Sanders. I mean, if I'm looking for problems, I can't be choosy, a guy like me, right? I don't have enough outsider candidates. I like Bernie Sanders. I like non-status quo kind of guys. I wish the left and I wish that contingent would calm down on the tax thing and start focusing more on real hard, and I understand hard questions, but how do we recreate opportunity for people? And not with talking points, but with a real understanding of what's happened, what's missing. And this is why sometimes we focus inordinately on things like the trade deals. But I think the trade deals undercut, you know, people's ability to compete. And I've said before, when you talk about systemic changes, how about teaching people to start businesses? And making it easier for them to do that. I mean, look at what a stupid podcaster can do here. There ought to be more people that can do this, and we ought to provide, I think that money would be better spent providing support for things like that than a lot of the ways, you know, we spend money, obviously. That's a bit of a rant there, I'm sorry. But to me, all of this is so old-fashioned. When I'm growing up and, you know, it's the era, the Marxist era, and the U.S., I mean, these ideas of taxing the rich so that we don't have as many rich people and that this is somehow going to raise up everybody else is as silly to me as the trickle-down economics was. The rich people are going to get all this money and they'll spend it, and the poor people, it will rain down upon them and we will have shared prosperity. Neither one of those situations seems true to me. Trickle-down doesn't trickle down, and taxing the wealthy doesn't create prosperity for the average Joes and Janes. I think we're just not addressing the issue, and I'll give Bernie Sanders credit in one respect. Unlike most of the other people in both debates, I think he's sincerely interested in trying to tackle that issue. That, to me, is more than these other folks are trying to do. I also think from a foreign policy standpoint, he's going to align much more closely to me. You know, I guess if Bernie Sanders is really as pro-Marxist as some of these right-wing websites claim, maybe he'd be happy to let the Russians take over the responsibility for eradicating Middle Eastern terrorism, too. I guess that would just be another area where Bernie Sanders and my ideas would dovetail, right? We're both okay to let the Russians take over the war on terror. Finally, the other candidates. Jim Webb was creepy. I know a lot of right-wingers like Jim Webb because he's a veteran, but at one point in the debate, you know, it was a dumb question. I thought Anderson Cooper did a better than I expected job of handling it, but there were some dumb questions. And one of them was, you know, who's the enemy you're most proud of making or something? And Jim Webb, trying to inject a political talking point that says, I was a Vietnam veteran. They all have these talking points. He says, the guy I killed, basically. It looked creepy and weird at a Democratic get together. Might have worked better at the GOP one, but did not play in front of this particular audience. Lincoln Chafee had the best line of the night, but he didn't mean it that way. When they asked him about a vote he made, he essentially answered, like, my dog ate it. I think he said something like, that was my first vote ever. It didn't matter because it was so one-sided. My dad had recently died. I mean, he threw out multiple excuses and hoped that any of them stick right in a row. Boom, 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 boom. And I thought, God, I almost respect that. You're such a good excuse maker. I mean, listen, there's some political talent to that, too. There's going to be a lot of times it'll be good to make an excuse. You might say that modern U.S. leaders should have a few of those in their back pocket, right? O'Malley, I can't get into O'Malley, former Maryland governor. I don't know. It's you know, my problem, folks, is the when you run into these plastic people, Ted Cruz on the Republicans and Marco Rubio feel similar to me, where you just look at them and you just go, they're in a wax museum. They're propped up there. I mean, Rubio ended up taking a bunch of money, I guess, from the Koch brothers. And all of a sudden, you know, on the trail now, pro-fracking, pro-this. I mean, it's just so obvious. So watching the Democratic debate, how do you say this nicely? Folks, it's Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And it's Hillary Clinton because the system here is not designed to give you the non-establishment candidate. Bernie Sanders has you all excited because he's the guy who's going to shake up the system. The Democratic Party doesn't want the system shaken up, and you can see that. But this is why our system, folks, is inadequate to the task right now, because the task requires us to elect people who can fix things. The system is now being designed in a way where if people are offering the kind of solutions that would have enough of an impact to potentially fix things, the parties don't want those people elected. If the status quo is poisonous, it's a real problem if the two parties that control the candidates you have a chance to elect, you know, profit from the poison. Neither party has an interest in people that will shake up the status quo. And yet the status quo is getting us what we have right now, that everybody, I mean, every poll shows, I mean, Ben, wasn't it the other day? Is the history thing fixed, Ben? Okay. Well, so you probably didn't see the other day. Wasn't there a poll that once again showed, you know, government corruption to be the number one concern Americans have? Folks, these are trends that are converging and slamming into each other, and one of them has to give. If enough people become upset about government corruption, but we don't elect people that will do anything about government corruption, something's going to happen. I don't know what it is, but those two lines, when they cross, are not going to cross quietly. At some point, either the system is going to start working like a clog in a sink that finally has enough water pressure to push it through, or it's going to back up, and then we're going to see weirdness happen. It's the same thing I wish we could plan for more when we're involved in these conflicts in the Middle East, and you go, oh God, didn't see ISIS coming to take over the oil wells in Syria. Oh gosh, didn't see Putin coming all of a sudden to put boots on the ground and get air power going. Oh God, didn't see those two converging lines between Americans getting upset at the lack of reform in a government that seems bought and paid for and candidates who aren't going to do anything about that continually dominating the elections. We'll see what happens, but as usual, I am the bringer of good news to all of you. Ting is mobile service made easy. We've been talking about them for some time on this program. You know, they are an intrusion into the old cell phone business model, and this happens in industries as they're maturing, as I think most of us know. Initially, companies show up that, you know, I mean, think of AT&T with phones, that nobody can provide it but them, which means, you know, there's not a lot of competition. And then eventually those things open up more and more, and you get more diversity in pricing and services, and companies start to differentiate themselves based on certain known strengths and weaknesses. Enter Ting into the cell phone realm. This is a customer service company. That's their niche. That's how they've chosen to differentiate themselves from the other companies out there. And I just wonder, do you do much shopping around when you pick a cell phone service company, a provider? Because I know people whose idea of shopping around is maybe going from, you know, cell phone giant who sponsors Super Bowl ads A, and checking out, you know, cell phone giant that has hundreds of physical stores in every mall in America company B, and notice that there's not much of a difference. You kind of have to get away from those old line companies to find out, you know, what the really nimble, unique companies trying to exploit certain niches in the business, what they're doing. I mean, if I asked you if you were paying $23, $25 a month for your cell phone service, what would you say? Because I can see one of two answers. One answer is, yes, that is about what I'm paying. And then I would say, oh, you're probably with someone like Ting. You use Ting? That would be what I would say. If, on the other hand, you say to me, $23 a month for a cell phone service, are you crazy? You can't get them for that cheap. Then I would suggest you should go over to Ting, bring your last physical bill for your cell phone service with you. Plug in the numbers into their savings calculator on the website and see how much you might save. According to Ting, a business with 11 to 20 employees' average annual savings per device was $440. If your job is to run a business more efficiently, you might want to check out Ting's savings calculator, too. In addition, unlike those other giant companies that really couldn't handle customer support for the amount of people they're dealing with, even if they wanted to, good luck getting a live person on the phone. Ting prides itself on your ability to do things like that. You might not even have to, considering their innovative, you know, management tools online that allow you to manage your account. If a company with that sort of an ethos appeals to you, it might be worth you checking into. These are the kind of companies, by the way, that's what they want you to do in the ads. They don't say, buy this, do that. They say, just check us out, because they're pretty confident that if you actually do, it'll be a no-brainer. I mean, in fact, Ting even operates on two different phone networks now, so that you can customize, you know, which service you use based on the specifics of the area you may live in or how you use data. It's definitely worth checking out, and I think Ting is pretty confident that if you do, for the vast majority of people out there, you'll find out that there's a better way to do cell phone service. And by the way, if you sign up with them, do so at dancarlin.ting.com, and you'll get a $25 service credit.
You want to help the podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it. Here's how it works. It's very simple. It won't cost you any more. Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.